In this episode, the Fifth Circuit hears argument in United States versus Madrid, a case that tests how far the Second Amendment reaches after the Supreme Court's recent gun rights decisions. Anthony James Madrid was convicted of using a firearm during and in relation to drug trafficking. He received a mandatory 10-year consecutive sentence under federal law. He now argues that conviction violates the Second Amendment as applied to him because he fired the gun in self-defense inside his home when masked intruders came to collect a drug debt. The core legal issue is whether the Second Amendment protects someone who uses a firearm in defense of his home when that use occurs during drug trafficking activity. Madrid brings this challenge on collateral review through a petition under Section 2255, which allows a federal prisoner to attack his conviction or sentence on constitutional grounds. The case also involves several procedural hurdles: whether Madrid filed too late, whether he waived his right to appeal, and whether the government forfeited its objections by not raising them in the district court. Demont Morgan now begins the argument for Anthony James Madrid.
Docket this morning is 25-40161, United States versus Madrid. Mr. Morgan.
Good morning, Your Honors. Demonte Morgan of Foreman, Watkin & Crutes for the appellant, Mr. Anthony James Madrid. With me at council table and on the brief is my colleague, Mr. Peyton Smith. At the founding, everyone would have understood that a man who took up arms in defense of his home and himself and his family against masked intruders was exercising a right protected under the Second Amendment. Today, that man is serving a mandatory 10-year consecutive sentence, not because the government has identified a founding-era law that imposed such a penalty, but because Congress passed one in 1968. Under Bruin, Rahimi, and Hamani, that law cannot stand as applied against Mr. Madrid. This court can and should reach that conclusion today because Mr. Madrid's claim is squarely cognizable on collateral review. The cognizability question is not complicated. As the Supreme Court explained in Davis against United States, that analysis concerns whether a petitioner has asserted a legally recognized basis for relief under Section 2255.
Section 2255 is the federal statute that allows someone in federal custody to challenge the legality of his sentence or conviction in the court that sentenced him. It is the primary tool for collateral review of federal convictions. Unlike a direct appeal, which follows immediately after sentencing, a Section 2255 motion is filed after the conviction becomes final. There are strict time limits, usually 1 year, and certain procedural bars. Courts use Section 2255 to correct fundamental constitutional errors, newly recognized constitutional rules, or other serious defects that could not or were not raised on direct appeal.
And it is straightforward here because all agree that Bruin, one, announced a substantive rule of constitutional law, that two, applies retroactively.
New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin is a 2022 Supreme Court decision that clarified the framework for reviewing Second Amendment challenges. It held that the government must justify a firearm regulation by showing it is consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. When the Supreme Court announces a new rule of constitutional law, the question becomes whether that rule applies retroactively to cases already final on direct review. A substantive rule, one that forbids criminal punishment of certain conduct, generally does apply retroactively. Both sides here agree that Bruin announced such a rule.
But the government's got an array of arguments against cognizability. One is timeliness. The supplement to the habeas petition was more than a year after Bruin was announced. The other is the deal that he got, which was a lot of benefits to him, included an appeal waiver provision. You want to address those two points?
Of course. I want to start by saying that the cognizability argument and the procedural bar argument are two separate analyses under Supreme Court precedent. And as I say in the brief, sometimes they come together, but for purposes of this analysis, they are different because we agree that it's a substantive rule of law that applies retroactively. I think that's important because the government...
Is it cognizable would encompass, was it done timely, and did you waive the right to file the habeas?
Right. And so what I was about to say is I think that's important because the government has either waived or at the very least forfeited all of its procedural bar arguments by not raising them in the district court. And the government had the opportunity to do so. Mr. Madrid filed a motion for leave to supplement his 2255 petition that sat on the district court's document for almost 6 months, and the government did not respond. The government also had a second opportunity to respond to that petition when the district court magistrate judge issued its report and recommendations. At that point, the magistrate judge made clear that if any party had any issue with any findings of fact or conclusion of law contained in that report and recommendation, that they should do so within 14 days. Again, the government did not raise any issue with the court's analysis of the Bruin claim. And so we think that the government has waived that argument, and at the very least, it's forfeited it. But those arguments fail on their own merits, too. So to take Your Honor's concern about the timeliness argument, again, we think, given that the government has waived and forfeited the argument, we are entitled to equitable tolling on that claim, or at the very least, equity should work in Mr. Madrid's favor.
You're not making a relation back argument to the ineffectiveness claim. It was untimely, but the government didn't object, and or equitable tolling allows it.
That's right, Your Honor. I think we read this court's Fifth Circuit precedent to be very strict on the relation back with review.
Relation back is a doctrine that allows an amendment to a pleading to be treated as if it were filed on the date of the original pleading. In habeas cases, this matters because there is a one-year statute of limitations. If a petitioner files a timely petition raising one claim and later tries to add a new claim based on a new Supreme Court decision, the question is whether that new claim relates back to the original filing date. Courts are strict about this in Section 2255 cases. The new claim usually must arise from the same core facts as the original claim to relate back.
With respect to the 2255.
What about the appeal waiver?
And so on the appeal waiver, we think the United States Supreme Court's recent decision in the United States against Hunter is instructive here.
Hunter versus United States is a recent Supreme Court case that addressed the scope of appeal waivers in plea agreements. Historically, many circuits held that a defendant could waive almost any right to appeal, even claims that the sentence was unlawful. Hunter clarified that certain fundamental claims, particularly those alleging a miscarriage of justice, may survive an appeal waiver. The decision leaves open the precise boundaries of what can and cannot be waived, but it signals that waivers are not absolute and must be read against the backdrop of constitutional protections.
And that basically says that there is an additional way to read the appeal waiver that would allow for appellants to bring claims.
Okay, so your argument isn't a waiver one there. Your argument is this fits the miscarriage exception. Third.
That's correct. I think that would be our primary argument there. And then as to the procedural bar, again, it's waived and forfeited. But
why was it waived and forfeited? Because his direct appeal was knocked out because of the waiver, right?
I'm sorry?
He had a direct appeal.
He had a direct appeal.
It was a summary dismissal because defense attorney Anders' brief, we got a waiver here. So the government has asserted the waiver. That's how the direct appeal disappeared.
Right. We read their procedural bar argument to be arguing that Mr. Madrid should have raised the claim earlier before the district court, the 2255 Bruin claim earlier before the district court. And in that way, it's very similar to the timeliness analysis with respect in our position, that they should have raised that before the district court.
But your further argument, I take it, therefore, is Supreme Court rejected the notion of a waiver in a situation where someone could be going to jail for a crime they didn't commit.
Exactly. And in this case, the Supreme Court is confirmed and affirmed time and again that the Second Amendment is not a second-class right, and that if somebody is subject to a penalty under the Second Amendment that they should not have been subjected to, they should be able to bring that claim. And so I think that takes us to the merits of the government's claim. The government is sort of wrong at every step of the Bruin analysis.
How are they wrong at this simple step? Our court has said if you've in the past been a drug trafficker, it's fine to convict you for possessing a gun. That's Kimball. How could it possibly be that those people can go to jail, but someone who's presently a drug trafficker using a gun can't? I just have a really hard time reconciling Kimball as our law. Past drug traffickers can go to jail for a gun, but if you're presently trafficking, you're fine to grab a gun.
Your Honor, I think there are a couple answers to that question. I'm going to try and sort of align in my head.
Isn't that the essence of this?
No.
No.
Okay. We think the essence of this claim is Heller, in that this is conduct that occurred inside Mr. Madrid's home.
But his factual basis makes that problematic, right? He has never withdrawn the factual basis that says he's shooting at people that want to collect on drugs.
He did not withdraw that factual basis, but we also don't think the factual basis precludes that argument, Your Honor, because in this case, the factual basis, all he alleged is that mass intruders were coming to his home to collect a drug debt and that he was engaged in a drug trafficking business. We think that and of course the government wrote that factual basis, Mr. Madrid agreed. We don't contest the factual basis, I want to be clear. But for the purposes of our self-defense in the home argument, we think we still retain that argument because, as is clear from the factual basis, he was in his home, people were coming to his home to engage in some kind of offense against him, and he protected himself and his family.
Has our court ever said in the 922G context that the location makes a difference? Or are you asking us to be the first court to say that?
We are not asking you to be the first court to say that, Your Honor, and I do want to be clear about the question. The 922G context is different from what we're arguing.
I know, but in any context, post-Bruin, has any circuit yet said it's different because there's an enhanced Second Amendment if you're in your home?
I think all the circuits recognize that that is the core right that Heller protects. They have not said that 924C is different in that respect. But I think what is important is that this court has to apply the analysis that the Supreme Court outlined in Bruin and Rahimi and Hamani.
The Supreme Court's decisions in Bruin, Rahimi, and other recent cases establish a two-step test for Second Amendment challenges. Step 1 asks whether the regulated conduct falls within the plain text of the Second Amendment. Does it involve the people, arms, and keeping or bearing? If yes, the presumption is that the conduct is protected. Step 2 then asks whether the government can justify the regulation by pointing to historical analogs, laws from the founding era or the 19th century that imposed comparable burdens for comparable reasons. The government bears the burden at step 2. Courts may not use means-end scrutiny or interest balancing.
And if this court applies that analysis sort of strictly as it's supposed to, it is clear that the government cannot proceed.
But he shoots outdoor. He hits his girlfriend.
That's right, but in self-defense.
That's like a public nuisance, which is the basis for the going armed laws.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Isn't that, we're not looking for a twin, we could just go looking for an analog.
That's right.
You stand at your door and you spray guns enough that you're even hitting your own girlfriend. That sounds like a public nuisance, which undergirds the going armed laws.
But I think it matters here, Your Honor, that he was doing it in self-defense. He was not going armed to the terror.
Let's just test that a little bit. Let's suppose this had all happened outdoors, not in the enclave at the home in a public park. He's sitting in the public park with his girlfriend. He's armed. Masked people come towards him who he recognizes are coming to collect a drug debt, and they have a shootout there in the public park. Is he entitled to defend himself with a gun in a public park in a drug transaction, a drug-related transaction?
Right. Your Honor, I think that would be a closer case. Of course, it's not the case here. But I think what is important, too, is that even in that situation, that person is not going armed to the terror of the public. And Your Honor stated no facts that would suggest that
person... Well, he's armed because he's protecting his drugs. He's protecting his home, but the reason he's... in the situation that he's in, having to protect himself in either position is because he's a drug dealer. And it's unlawful to possess a gun in connection with drug dealing without regard to where you are.
You
can't say, I'm allowed to have a gun in my home because I'm a drug dealer and I need it for defense. It's against the law to even possess the gun in your home with the drugs.
That is right, Your Honor. Only because Congress has made it against the law, and of course this court has said that the fact that Congress has made something against the law is not determinative of the Second Amendment protection. But I think what is important to Your Honor's question is that this court has explained in United States against Daniel, and the Supreme Court explained in Hamani, that the fact that a person might do something sometimes doesn't mean they're engaged in that thing all the time. So that was sort of central to the court's reasoning there. And so I think the same reasoning applies here. There is no sort of nothing in the factual basis that says that at the time that they came, Mr. Madrid was engaged in a drug trafficking situation.
Well, the reason they were there was because he had been engaged in the drug trafficking, and he was using the gun to protect himself in connection with the drug trafficking enterprise.
Your Honor, I think if the court took that line of reasoning, these cases get a lot more complicated than they have to under Supreme Court precedent, because it assumes that somebody who was once engaged in the drug trafficking offense is always engaged in the drug trafficking offense. And that, of course, will include conduct that reaches somebody's second amendment.
Well, the reason this incident occurred, I thought he said, was because they were coming to collect on a drug debt.
That's right. And indeed.
So it was part of a drug transaction.
That's what the factual basis says, Your Honor. But I think at the time that at the time that they came to his home, and the government concedes this sort of at the sentencing hearing, the government says Mr. Madrid was defending himself and his family. And so I think, you know, we recognize that the Second Amendment right, the core of the Second Amendment right, is self-defense, and that right is heightened in the home. But I think what's more important is that we hold the government to...
And the reason that Congress passed the gun laws about guns in connection with drug trafficking is precisely that, to protect so that guns lead to violence in connection with drug trafficking. And they don't want you to have your wife and your kids in your home with drugs and a gun.
Right. Well, I think that gets to the how and why analysis that's a part of the Bruin second step, Your Honor. And I think it's important here because the government hasn't presented you with a single analog from the founding era that shows that that founders passed laws that operated in the same way. And of course, there were, you know, people were smuggling contraband at the founding. And so there was this type of activity going on at the founding. And so you would expect to see an analog that made it a heightened offense for those people to be armed while doing that. Of course, the government has not presented that analog, and we think that's determinative here. What Your Honor is getting at sort of goes to the government's argument about the first step, where we're talking about whether there's a lawful purpose sort of addition to the first step of the Bruin analysis. And I think at this point, the Supreme Court has made it clear that that is not a limitation that occurs at the first step. And the first step is, of course, a plain text analysis. Justice Barrett explains sort of in her Wolfert concurrence that when we're looking at history at the first step, it is to determine sort of what bear arms means, for example. It is not to import a limitation that does not exist, because that gets us right back to means and scrutiny, which the court, of course, repudiated in Bruin. So what we're looking at is he a member of the people? And I think all the Supreme Court cases that have come out since Bruin sort of show that that is sort of a plain text analysis that is easy on the face when that person is an American. It doesn't matter that they may have been engaged in unlawful conduct. And then at step two, the government has the burden of presenting to you some evidence, you know, some regulation from the founding era that would do what they are trying to do here, and they haven't done that. And so just applying the facts of this case to the burden, I think it's clear that Bruin requires that this conviction be vacated. Merely because the government hasn't met its burden. And so, you know, we would argue that the conviction should be vacated for that reason.
So you're on the 28J unpublished Belk decision. You think that court's just wrong?
We think the unpublished decision in Belk suffers from the same issues that the Sixth Circuit.
It's a step one error.
It's a step one error, and that they are importing that sort of lawful purpose reading into step one, which the Supreme Court has made clear that it shouldn't be there.
And a lot of courts are struggling, and you've made very coherent arguments. Let's imagine, this is my last question, but let's imagine instead of being in the habeas context, the government charged you as it did, but the case has just come down. You file a motion to dismiss, right, saying Second Amendment, and then what happens?
So then...
Because you want to say I'm just a home defender. I don't even know anything about drug dealing. I'm just a home defender. And the government wants to say, no, you're a drug dealer, sort of their argument now. Does that go to a district judge at a dismissal stage, or does that have to go to the jury?
I think that could go to, I think it would look the same, Your Honor, as it presently looks, in that it would go to the district judge. The district judge would hold the government to their burden to see, you know, once we've asserted that this is unconstitutional as applied to whoever the defendant is in that situation, the government would have to show a founding error analog that makes it constitutional. And so I think it doesn't...
But the predicate critical question of, is he or isn't he a drug dealer? Who makes that finding?
I think it's two separate questions, Your Honor. That goes to the drug dealing offense that was also charged here and that Mr. Madrid pled to. But I think for the question of the 924C charge, we don't really have to get into that.
I do have one other question. Let's say you prevail. Let's say our panel agrees with you. What's the relief? Am I right that the government gets back to square one? They get to re-indict whatever they want? And that would include a 922G, in this case, clearly supportable by Kimball. And you lose the count, you got dismissed, you lose the guideline recommendation. See what I'm saying? What's the relief here?
Yeah, the relief is that the 924C conviction would be vacated, and the government, of course, has whatever options it has available to it to proceed at that point. But we don't think that, of course...
She pled. So they just go back to square one?
Right. And, of course, there was a 922G1 charge here.
Yeah.
I think that highlights the point, Your Honor, that the government has at its disposal a number of charges that they could have made. They don't have to win on the 924C charge, and of course here they cannot because they cannot meet the Bruin standard. But not everything that is a crime has to be a federal crime, and so there are probably state law crimes that could be brought in these situations too. I think the important thing is that once the Constitution prescribes this conduct, we don't give the government a free pass just because this is the crime they chose to bring as opposed to any other crime. Here, the Second Amendment is clear that Mr. Madrid had this ability to defend himself in his home. The government hasn't presented a founding era analog suggesting that he would not have had that opportunity, and so the conviction must be vacated.
But let me make sure I understand this. It's because there's an appeal waiver, and you say you get around that with Hunter, doesn't that vitiate the entire plea agreement?
I don't think so, Yaron. If I understand the question correctly, we're saying that Mr.
The government made the deal on the basis that the plea would stick. And if you say if the appeal waiver is taken out, doesn't that dissolve the bargain, so to speak? And so the plea agreement, there's no longer a plea agreement. Everything goes out the window. The government can start up.
I'm not sure. My thought process would be, Your Honor, that the appeal waiver is a contract. And of course, all contracts are made against the backdrop of the law. And so in this situation, we would read the appeal waiver to sort of carve out this exception that the court has already determined may apply. And so the rest of it would go forward as if the parties agreed to it. That would be my frontline answer here right now. I will reserve the rest of my time for a while.
Bradley Visosky now begins the argument for the United States.
Good morning, Your Honors. Bradley Visosky for the government. Counsel, may it please the court. Just like to start by just discussing the extraordinary nature of the claim that Mr. Madrid is making, that the Second Amendment to the Constitution protects not only the right to keep and bear arms, but the right to keep and bear arms to facilitate illegal activity here, drug traffic. As a matter of common sense, we know that that can't be the case, but we don't have to rely just on common sense. As the Sixth Circuit in Underwood explained, which dealt with this precise issue, the Supreme Court has extensively explored what the meaning of to keep and bear arms within the meaning of the Second Amendment is. And so you look at a case like Cruikshank over 150 years ago that made clear that it's a right to keep and bear arms for lawful purposes.
District of Columbia versus Heller is the landmark 2008 Supreme Court case that recognized an individual right to keep and bear arms for self-defense in the home. Some language in Heller and later cases refers to the right to bear arms for lawful purposes. Lower courts have debated whether that phrase is merely descriptive or imposes a freestanding limitation at step one of the analysis. The question here is whether someone engaged in drug trafficking is excluded from Second Amendment protection at the threshold, before any historical analysis, simply because his purpose was unlawful.
And this was reinforced in Heller, and it was reinforced in McDonald, Justice Alito's opinion. This characterized Heller's central holding as the right to keep and bear arms for essential for lawful purposes. And this is again reinforced just a couple weeks ago in Wolford. Again, Justice Alito, he kind of went out of his way at the beginning of that opinion to explain that, look, the Second Amendment is not absolute. It's not unlimited. And what did he point to? Heller, that you can't keep and bear arms in whatever manner and for whatever purpose whatsoever.
This is jumping to the merits, which right? You're making a step one argument.
Correct.
The step one. Right. The government keeps making it. I don't see that the Supreme Court has embraced it, but I'm not sure it's even open to our panel. They cite Connolly. You know Connolly.
Correct.
And it looks to me like we've said that's just not so. We say marijuana user or not, Paola is a member of our political community and thus has a presumptive right to bear arms.
That goes to the person that's protected under the Second Amendment, Your Honor.
Well, he's a marijuana user. He's an illegal criminal.
Correct.
In the present tense.
Correct.
But he's still a member of the political community. Are you saying that drug traffickers are just worse and they can be a subset carved out?
No, we understand, for example, like in Diaz and Connolly, Your Honor, in terms of the who is protected under the Second Amendment, that this court has rejected our argument about law-abiding citizens. Our argument in this case is different. It's not the who, it's not the person that we're talking about, it's the what. It's the conduct that's protected by the Second Amendment.
Right, but the conduct there was illegal possession of marijuana. And we specifically said that conduct doesn't mean the Second Amendment is just for upright citizens.
I think in Connolly and Diaz, it's kind of more of a status argument, Your Honor. You have a status of a felon. You have a status as a controlled substance user. Here, it's very different. It's specifically focused on the conduct. And the Second Amendment does not protect the conduct of carrying firearms.
Well, how do you separate that from the possession? How do you square that with the fact that he was in illegal possession of the marijuana in the example set forth by Judge Higginson?
Because again, Your Honor, that's just more in my mind, more of like a status crime. You happen to be in possession of an illegal controlled substance or using it at the time that you're possessing a firearm. Here it's different. It's just assuming for the sake of argument that he's covered under the Second Amendment as a person, it's the conduct, and this was discussed.
You're still arguing step one.
Correct. And again, it's because the Supreme Court has defined the scope of the First Amendment right, and they have cited no case where any court has ever held that the Second Amendment covers this particular conduct.
Well, so assuming we don't agree with you, then where are we? Where are we?
On step one, Your Honor?
Yes.
Well, then you would go to step two, and the history argument, I think that is strong in our favor as well, and I think it's resolved by cases like Kimball and cases like Squire that came out just recently. The body of law that says that Congress can regulate or disbar from possessing firearms classes of people that Congress or legislatures deem dangerous. That was Kimball's Square holding. It was reaffirmed in Squire, and by the way, it was brought up on the initial argument about the context, the if there's any special enhancement for possessing or enhanced protection for possessing a firearm in the home, and that was covered squarely by Squire, that there is no additional protection, at least in this context. And it's even stronger in this case because, as Judge Higginson pointed out, here we're not talking about past conduct, we're talking about ongoing current conduct. So that argument is even stronger. And in terms of the how and the why, first the why, and again, it's what I just discussed, that legislatures, this court has recognized that, that legislatures can regulate conduct that are take firearms away from people that are deemed as a class dangerous. As to the how, all of the history is set forth at pages 40 to 42 of our brief, but I think the most compelling historical analog here are the enhanced penalties that applied throughout the nation's history, enhanced criminal penalties for carrying or using a firearm when engaging in crimes like armed robbery or burglary.
Throughout American history, legislatures have imposed enhanced criminal penalties when offenders use firearms during the commission of certain crimes. Examples include armed robbery, burglary, and carrying weapons to the terror of the public. These enhancements often took the form of higher fines, longer imprisonment, or in some eras, capital punishment or property forfeiture. Prosecutors argue these founding era and 19th century statutes serve as historical analogs to modern laws like Section 924C, which mandates additional prison time when a defendant uses or carries a firearm during a drug trafficking crime or crime of violence.
And the penalty there was much more severe even than an issue here. It involved a state forfeiture or potentially death. Third Circuit in Cash, it's an unpublished opinion, but there's a footnote from Judge Schwartz. It's not a concurrence, just kind of like, it's kind of odd, it's just like his opinions on the subject, but the main panel decided in the government's favor on step one. For step two, Judge Schwartz noted that these analogs, these enhanced penalties for armed robbery and burglary, are the identical means to 924C, which imposes enhanced penalty, not only for distributing drugs, and that's what Mr. Madrid was charged and convicted of in count one, but carrying and using a firearm during and in relation to distributing drugs.
Madrid couldn't have brought his Bruin argument at the time of the indictment and the guilty plea because we didn't yet have Bruin, right?
He couldn't have cited Bruin, obviously, Your Honor.
But so let's just imagine the exact same indictment was brought, but it's now, it's today. And he files a motion to dismiss saying, I've got Second Amendment as applied protection. I don't understand your theory. You go into that motion to dismiss and you say to the judge, no, the Second Amendment doesn't apply because we promise you we'll prove he's a drug trafficker when we get to trial. The argument here is very difficult for me to understand how it actually works in practice. You're saying you have step one, no Second Amendment motion to dismiss, because we promise we'll prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he didn't have a lawful purpose.
I think in that case it would require a trial, Your Honor. I agree with you there. But here, he pleaded guilty to those facts that he just not only possessed, not only carried, not only used, but discharged the weapon during and in relation to the drug trafficking crime.
Okay, so all future 924Cs are open to as-applied Second Amendment attacks because your argument is the disqualified user world hasn't yet been proven as to this guy. He may just be defending his house. That's what he says, right?
Right.
Okay, so this is a very narrow merit Second Amendment argument you're making, that just because he did a factual basis that committed him to being drug trafficker. That's right?
Correct, Your Honor. Or if you have a trial and he's been convicted of it. I agree with you. I think it would be hard to kind of imagine how that would work factually to prove that without having had a trial.
You see, this is a problem that's sort of across the nation right now. Because when courts are saying dangerousness, even as a predicate, is what disallows them, of course, the person saying they're not dangerous.
Correct.
Where do they get to argue?
Correct, Your Honor. I think it would be at a trial by being acquitted.
But not under ours.
That's not a drug trafficker. Yeah.
Now, of course, you've gone through about half your time. We've asked you about the merits. The Second Amendment is complicated, but you have this whole set of arguments. You heard his response. The appeal waiver, the cases you cite, Barnes, Jones, are cases that were explicitly abrogated in the Supreme Court explicitly said, we abrogate Fifth Circuit Barnes. That's the case you rely on in your brief.
Right, saying that there is no miscarriage of justice exception. And of course, the Supreme Court recognized there is one now. Now, the contours of it are very undefined.
No, but we know one thing, the case you relied on to say the waiver still controls. The Supreme Court has said that case doesn't control. The
Correct.
Fifth Circuit was wrong.
So I think now you're under Hunter land. So we would assert the waiver. And by the way, regardless of any forfeiture of the procedural defenses, this is the first opportunity we've had in the 2255 context to invoke the appellate waiver. So, and his plea agreement, he agreed not to contest his conviction or sentence in any appeal. So that is presented as a matter of first instance before this court. Now, whether...
I agree with that. Yeah. You invoked it on the first direct appeal. Then you chose not to invoke it when he filed his habeas, even though the waiver would have let you invoke it at the district court level. Fine. We are now back on appeal. You're invoking it. But you're invoking it based on Barnes, and the Supreme Court has said Barnes isn't good law. We don't hide behind waivers if the person isn't guilty of a crime at all. Do you accept all that?
Well, I think that Hunter said that Barnes isn't good law to the extent that the Fifth Circuit has not recognized a manifest miscarriage of justice exception. I don't know that it goes so far as to say that there's no realm under which you can't waive a constitutional claim.
But what greater miscarriage could there be than allowing someone to stay in jail if they're actually not guilty of the crime?
I think there's some force to that argument, Your Honor.
Okay.
To be honest.
Is the timeliness different? Is the timeliness argument different?
Timeliness argument is completely different, and I think, frankly, it's our strongest one.
Yeah, I do, too. Do you want to walk us through it?
Sure. No matter how you look at where the tolling begins, I mean, his conviction is final in 2021. He actually files his first 2255 before his conviction is final. Bruin comes out within a year. Mr. Madrid does nothing. And then almost 2 years after Bruin is decided is when he files his motion for leave to supplement. So you don't have to get into the retroactivity question of Bruin. You don't have to get into whether Bruin covers this exact application of 924C, which cases like Barranza Gutierrez that we cited from the Eighth Circuit dealt with. You don't have to get into any of that. I mean, it's just plainly barred, and they've never had any argument to the contrary. I think in the reply brief they say it isn't untimely.
Well, they do say you didn't invoke untimeliness when you were at the habeas district court level.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, there's nothing...
Why did that not happen?
What we should have done, Your Honor, and Mr. Morgan's right, what we should have done is respond to the motion for leave to supplement with an argument, which I think would have been a failsafe, that any amendment is futile because of these procedural defenses. We didn't do that, Your Honor, and Your Honors, and I think that's in large part, and this isn't an excuse, but just the nature of 2255. We normally respond to those when we're ordered. It didn't happen. We should have done it. And then we had another opportunity once the court granted the motion for leave and then to respond to it. And that's where we point out in the brief that, yes, we could have filed objections to the magistrate judge's report and recommendation that, oh, by the way, there are all these other procedural defenses that we could have raised, but the court didn't go into, but... You know, at that point, we'd won. And so both statute of limitations and procedural default, this court can consider sua sponte.
Sua sponte means on the court's own motion, without a party's request. Appellate courts sometimes have the power to raise and decide issues sua sponte, even if neither party raised them below. This is especially true for jurisdictional questions or issues that go to the finality and integrity of judgments. In habeas cases, courts of appeals have recognized the authority to consider procedural bars like the statute of limitations or procedural default sua sponte, even when the government did not object in the district court, because these rules serve important systemic interests in finality.
Willis case you cited in our brief for procedural default, it's Vargas Soto would be the case. for statute of limitations. And we think that the rights here are the interests that are implicated in finality and finality of convictions and timely raising claims overcome our failure to raise it in the district court. And as we point out, Mr. Madrid has had an opportunity now thoroughly on appeal to explore those issues, particularly with the statute of limitations. There's just no argument that he has presented or really honestly could present to show that it's not barred by the statute of limitations.
Your thoughts on the questions Judge Richman and I asked opposing counsel about what would the relief be here? Because it was a pretty good deal, non-prosecution element, appeals guideline recommendation, dismiss count, and you had the appeal waiver. So let's say he prevails, he gets to undo his guilty plea. What happens then? Government can re-prosecute on all of the above, even the 924C?
I don't know the 924C, Your Honor, because anything that we would be able to prove at trial, we've already proven by virtue of his guilty plea. So if this court takes the extraordinary step of overturning it, I don't know what we'd be able to prove that he hasn't already admitted.
Because at a new trial, you could use the factual statement?
Yeah, I think it would be I don't know. I mean, it seems that it would be an admission, but there might be some case out there that I'm just not aware of that you can.
So the difficulty when there's a guilty plea, there's a direct appeal, goes nowhere, comes up on habeas. Let's say there's a persuasive argument. What happens? Because the government negotiated away a lot on contemplating they had a plea. So I've always thought they can get recovered at all. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, one thing about the factual basis, Your Honor, and counsel brought this up in his argument about self-defense. Just to be clear, there's absolutely no evidence in this record of self-defense. The factual basis that he signed doesn't talk about it. He specifically admitted that he discharged the weapon intending to strike the drug traffickers coming to collect the drug debt. There's no fact in either his factual basis or in the declaration that he submitted after the R&R came out, which we don't think should be considered. But even if it were, even in that, there's no basis for self-defense. There's no recitation of fact in there that the creditors had entered the home. And what Mr. Madrid did,
was the girlfriend in the home or out of the home?
The girlfriend was in the home and the son was in the home. So what he's claiming is
they got hit.
Yeah. What he's claiming is he sees these masked people come to his home. He thinks that they're going to come in and break down the door. He thinks that there's no evidence. He hears footsteps because he told his wife and son to go hide in the bathroom or bedroom or someplace. He hears footsteps and just shoots.
So he did shoot inside the house.
Inside the house, but there's no evidence in the record, even in the declaration, that the intruders were in the house. And so the greater inference here is not that this was self-defense, but that he was protecting his drugs. You're going to open fire on people that you don't know if they're armed. He admits he owes them the drug debt. Why not just say, I have all this cocaine in here. I acknowledge I owe you this money. Here it is. He just opens fire. That's not self-defense. There's absolutely no basis in the record for self-defense. And, of course, he can't contradict the admissions in his factual basis. But I do just want to circle back briefly. I really think that this is a first step through in case. The Second Amendment does not protect the conduct at issue here of discharging a firearm during and in relation to a drug trafficking crime, which Mr. Madrid admitted to. And unless the court has any further questions, I would just rely on the brief. Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court. I just want to pick up with where opposing counsel left off on the self-defense claim. And of course, we contend that this wasn't self-defense, but you don't have to take our words for it. Page 6 of the sentencing transcript is where the government is speaking at the sentencing hearing. The government's counsel says, Mr. Madrid was attempting to protect his family from a home invasion of some drug dealers at the time he shot. And so we think that there is enough basis in the record to find that he was engaged in self-defense. And of course, that is the core of the Second Amendment right. I also want to touch on the court's concerns about cognizability and timeliness again before I go to my seat. Again, that argument is waived. I think it would be weird indeed for the court to rule on the government's procedural arguments here, given that they were waived at least twice at the trial court level. When the government is arguing that Mr. Madrid himself waived his Second Amendment claim, I think equity requires.
But if the COA includes cognizability, and you've had plenty of time to brief it, I'm still not sure I understand why he can wait on Bruin as long as he did. Put the waivers aside, and I often put aside the waiver at disadvantage to the government. We've got a case in front of us, let's just assess it. What's the justification for waiting that long?
Your Honor, Mr. Madrid says that that's when he found out. That's what he says in his 22.
We don't usually permit that.
Right. And so we argue that, you know, waiver would be inappropriate here because the government has also waived their arguments. And so if waiver is going to attach to us, it has to attach to them as well.
On the merits, just your time's quick, have we, the Fifth Circuit, yet ever said as to a gun case that a defendant is stripped of Second Amendment protection at step one?
To my knowledge, no, Your Honor. The court has been very clear.
That would be a very significant ruling for us.
That would be, and it would be wrong, I would submit, under Supreme Court precedent. I think where the Supreme Court is going with this, based on my reading of the cases, is, you know, we have most of the historical evidence at this point, and that historical evidence is in the form of surety laws, going armed laws. These are all laws that are about offensive conduct, where a person is engaged in conduct outside the home to the terror of the people, as the statutes say. That is a very different situation from what we are engaged with here, which is a man trying to protect his home by the government's own words. And I think, you know, to Your Honor's question of the government, this has to be a case-by-case analysis under 24C in the same way that 922G has been treated as a case-by-case analysis, because the underlying facts are going to be so different. And so, for example, this case might get a different outcome than the example that Judge Richman presented, just because the factual situation is different.
What you might find status conduct distinction. Cases like Connolly all fall in status, no step one problem.
Right.
But now we're looking at a different component, which is they're not disqualified because they're immigrants. They're not disqualified because it's the conduct.
Right. And Your Honor, we think that's where Bruin Step 2 is even more important, because it provides that limiting principle that if you're looking at the conduct, you look at conduct that people engaged in at the founding to see if you can get a founding error analog to the conduct that we're engaged in here now. And so, you know, we would just submit that drug trafficking is an expansive crime under the code. And so it's probably not best to do a one-size-fits-all argument here for, you know, if this is drug trafficking and is entitled to a 924C offense, then the next case has to be. I see that my time has run, but we would ask that the court hold the government to its burden under Bruin and vacate Mr. Madrid's sentence.
Thank you, counsel. We have your argument. The court will take a brief recess.
The argument you just heard does not indicate how the panel will rule. The Fifth Circuit will issue a written opinion in due course. That opinion will decide whether Madrid's Bruin claim is procedurally barred, whether it survives his plea agreement's appeal waiver, and if the court reaches the merits, whether the Second Amendment protects the use of a firearm in self-defense when that use occurs during drug trafficking. The decision will add to the growing body of post-Bruin case law and may clarify the relationship between historical analogs, enhanced penalties, and as-applied constitutional challenges.